The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Christine Miller, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications at the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. Tom Felton became internationally famous for his role as the bleach blonde bad guy, Draco Malfoy, in the Harry Potter movie series, and more than a decade after the premiere of the last film, he and the other performers continue to cast a spell over fans around the world. In fact, Tom's signature Potter sneer is an enduring pop culture phenomenon, much like the boy who lived himself. Before his villainous turn at Hogwarts, Tom acted in such beloved films as The Borrowers and Anna and the King, and has followed up on his success in the Wizarding World with roles in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Belle, The Flash, and The Forgotten Battle, among many other film and television pursuits. This year, he made his West End theater debut in 222, A Ghost Story. In Beyond the Wand, Tom reflects on the highs and lows of navigating fame at a young age, living as a normal teenager through it all, and the lasting friendships he enjoys with his Harry Potter co-stars. Tonight, Tom is joined in conversation with singer-songwriter, author, and teacher Wesley Stace. Please join me in welcoming Tom and Wesley to the Free Library.
Can I grab this? Hi! My name's Tom. This is fun. Thank you so much for coming here tonight. This is surreal and exciting. I'll try to keep it less awkward than I'm doing now. But yeah, thank you so much for coming.
Don't worry, because I'm going to keep you in line. So, you've written a book. Just tell
Can
me.
Can we introduce ourselves first?
Yes, sure.
I feel a bit rude.
I think we may have just been introduced.
Oh, sorry, I missed that. I'm Tom Felton, I've written a book.
That's true. He's Tom Felton, he's written a book, and my name's Wesley Stace. I'm going to interview
Wesley,
him.
Wesley, yes,
it.
Thank you very much.
So, you've written a book, Beyond the Wand, which is a terrific title. Before we get into anything that's in the book, can you tell us why, you know, you wanted to write a book, what the process was of writing a book, and when you had the idea, how long it took, all those kinds of things.
I never wanted to write a book.
No.
I've got no intention of anyone reading it, really, so I'm quite grateful that you're here. No, these are genuinely my scribbles of paper that I wrote down over the last 10 years, or 20 years, in fact. I've always been a writer. I like pen to pad. It's quite cathartic and a relaxing way to finish my day, whether it's poetry or stories. And in fact, it was the whole notion of writing down Potter stories was about being at comic cons throughout the world. It's the comic conventions that have celebrated Potter and everything pop culture over the world. I've been lucky enough to witness a lot of that, and a lot of the stories, or questions rather, would allow me to sort of give a 2 or 3 minute anecdotal answer, and then I went back to my hotel room or whatever and just kept scribbling. So this is the result of 20 years of scribbling whilst making the Potter films. I think that's the best way to sum it up.
And how did you enjoy the process? Presumably you had an editor for the book, as everybody does. How did you enjoy the process of somebody, you know, suggesting other ways for it to go? And
it was difficult, that part, because I already had these scribbles of paper. They were stacks high. I went. It was during the pandemic that I started to try to put a timeline to it. I'm not sure if any of you have been to high school or like Muggle Hogwarts or whatever it is. As the years blend, it's very hard to be able to differentiate between what year one or year two or year three. And it's the same with the Potter films. It's quite difficult for us, it can be, to differentiate where those memories lie. So these things were already written down. It was with the help of the editors and people that they encouraged me to put it to a timeline. And also people encouraging me to tell more about the story than is just a sort of obvious, fluffy sort of behind the scenes Potter stories. Because, there was a lot more going on behind the scenes than maybe people would imagine. And hopefully they're all in the book.
I would like to say that we are going to have some Q&A at the end tonight. So think of those now so that when we come to that moment, you've thought of the Q.
Be gentle.
And he can supply the A. So going back then to, briefly to the beginning of your career.
Do we all live in Philadelphia? Okay, sorry. Yes, thank you. It's like I've passed through before, but... Oh my God, how beautiful was Philadelphia this evening. With the sun out, baseball game was playing. I got very, Okay,
famously the best sports fans in America.
Really? Okay, I've fanboyed enough. Let's move on.
But the beginning of your career was much more haphazard, I think, that most of us who think of kind of, as you say, your mum wasn't kind of a stage mum. They weren't throwing you on the stage. And it seems quite haphazard the way things happened, when you were a kid starting out. Your dad was kind of supportive, but mildly rather than massively. Your mum was very supportive, but it wasn't her idea. It was all quite surprising to me how kind of full of chance that all was, as you were just trying to get on with a normal kid life.
Is that a dumbed down word of haphazard, by the way? Because I love that word. Haphazard, but right place, right time is how I would say it. And very, very supportive parents. I've got three older brothers that you'll learn about in the book. We were all chancers. We all got up to a lot of mischief. And it was only through my mum's and I still it's her birthday today, by the way. Can we hear it out for my wait, save it because I'm going to do a little video at the end. But yeah, it was through her support, really. One month it was ice hockey, one month it was being a violinist or violinist, one minute it was, and my dad was slightly, I'm the youngest of the four. I'm sure he was quite exhausted at the relentless new passions. But my mum was very keen to make sure that we were all supported. So when I stopped playing violin after 2 months, she wasn't that pissed off at me, which is really cool. And it was my idea to say, hey, can we go to London and maybe try out this agency thing and maybe get a role in these things that have been so important in my life, which have been film, TV and theatre. And that was the happy accident that led to two films and a bit of TV work before the inevitable auditions at Potter.
And even before that, there was some suddenly one of your first gigs where you were flying to America and doing a credit card commercial or something? Yeah. And being mistaken for Macaulay Culkin on the street.
Can you imagine it? 7 years old. Yeah, it was bizarre. And obviously neither my mum or I wanted or wished that. It was just a really, really, again, haphazard situation where I was just lucky to be in the right place at the right time. But it definitely introduced me to the world of what it was like to be in front of a camera and not be too... startled by it. Although when I did get, for those of you who don't know, my very first scene as a hired actor was in New York City, where we were at Times Square, and there was part of it was sectioned off, and I was waving at a bunch of people that were waving back at me, who I thought were just immediately huge fans of Tom Felton. It turns out they thought I was Macaulay Culkin, or at least his brother. So yeah, it was a bizarre first taste of it, and it's quite beautifully ironic that I'm back here all these years later.
Which is also quite ironic, as you say in the book, given that, you know, Macaulay Culkin was somewhat created by Christopher Columbus, the director who was in charge of you as a very young boy.
Yeah.
On those first Potter movies.
Yeah, absolutely. Christopher Columbus.
And a great influence on you, I think.
Absolutely, yeah. Chris Columbus was the director of the first two films. He was definitely a huge influence on who was being cast. He had had previous experience with Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire. Right. Yeah, come on, Mrs. Doubtfire. Yeah, he was incredibly good at creating an environment where children weren't going to be too flustered by their environment, which is kind of how I got the part. I digress slightly, but...
That's a good... You should tell that story.
Okay, well...
You're bullshitting your way into the part.
Yeah. It's perfectly true, yeah. Essentially, there were so many people that wanted to go up for the Harry Potter auditions when we were young because so many people were fans of the books. And it was imperative for the producers and anyone else creating it that they were from Britain and they weren't child actors. They weren't Macaulay Culkin, essentially. So we were all lined up in a row, literally like 30 at a time, and being asked by the director, Chris Columbus, which part of the book are you most excited to see translated into the film? At this point, I was rather bored of hearing other people's answers, so I completely bullshitted and just repeated what the kid said next to me. I heard Quidditch, but I should also note at this point, I had not read the books. I had or the book. It was only one book at that point. I was the only person there that was not there off the steam of being passionate about the books. I was there because I'd done a couple of bits and pieces in the industry before. So I just lied through my ass and said the same thing that the kid said next to me and said Gringotts. I thought that was a really cool idea. I can't wait to see Gringotts flying around. Something tells me that most of you know what Gringotts is. So he knew I was BSing, for lack of a better phrase, and I think that might have planted the seed in his mind that maybe this guy's a good Draco.
Just before we get back to the chronology, one thing I thought when you said that was you said you hadn't read the book before you did the first movie. Something I don't think I found out over here is after you've made the first movie. And yeah, as it all developed, were you reading the books with increasing interest to find out what you would be doing in the future? Or didn't you do that?
Not really.
No. Can you read?
That's my line, I think. Didn't know you could read. No, I've... Very good. No, I was I was brought up with literacy. I can read... I think R.L. Stein, Roald Dahl was a huge thing. My dad used to read to me and my three older brothers, and he used to do the voices and very much act out the characters, which is where I'm sure I got a lot of my playfulness to be able to have fun with these sorts of characters. But no, by the time Potter came around, I was too cool for school. I had three older brothers, and the idea of reading in your spare time was not particularly cool. I wanted to be captain of the football team or I don't know, whatever it was, a BMXer or something like that. But it was Potter single-handedly. When that first film came out, or the first book came out, I remember my school teacher trying to tell us about the story of a boy in a cupboard who lives under the stairs, and remembering how uncool that sounded to me at the time, and single-handedly those books changing my reading habits for the rest of my life. Now I can't stop reading. It was Chamber of Secrets that really got me going. But yeah, was it the Basilisk? Because that got me. There's so many things about Chamber of Secrets. Yeah. We'll talk later. But it just sort of got me back into pages and actual, like, turning the pages over. And again, I digress further, but it's an amazing thing that these pages are still being turned and celebrated as much as they are now.
I like the idea that there was something in your kind of, the kind of, you say in the book, the kind of arrogance of your reply to him, like not, you know, really engaging. And he saw something in that. There was a quote that I really liked that refers to a really early audition when a little girl or a young stage actress she'd already decided what she was going to do at the moment.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you can say what that is. But the quote that I really liked was, acting is never about learning lines or whether you can cry on demand. It's about what's next, not what's now. Just react to what's around you. And it strikes me that the book is a very, it's kind of a lengthy question, but it strikes me the book's a very good example of how you've applied the lessons learnt in acting to real life. And also vice versa, if you know what I mean.
I do. I've been lucky enough to have both sides of it, to be honest with you, because I was so young when all this started that it wasn't necessarily naivety, but I was certainly not aware of all the things that I've had to come to realise as an adult actor now going into audition rooms. Back then it was very much just, well, having fun and larking about. And now it very much is the same because I've had the positive experiences of the previous one. That particular audition, the one that he's referring to, is because the girl that I was with, the audition was to open the door and see Mr. Bean. For those of you who don't know, that's Rowan Atkinson, who was like my childhood hero. So it was not a case of learning lines or knowing wizardry. It was just open the door and mimic the idea of what it would be like to have Rowan Atkinson turn up at your door. And the girl next to me asked if she could faint. And the producers, there was only three of them, I think, just immediately looked at each other and was like, we'd rather you didn't. But she did. She opened the door and shouted the words, Mother Goose. And she hit the deck. And I didn't do any acting at all. I never even opened my door. I just reacted to her going, what the fuck is she doing? And I think that was what the producers saw, that I wasn't intimidated by people reacting around me to get that part. I also thought I should mention, because there's a story I thought you were going into about after being lined up and being proven that I know absolutely nothing about Potter with my Gringotts idea. They did a thing where the 30 kids were left on our own, where the cameras were being turned off and we were allowed to just integrate. Clearly, for me, highly professional actor, this was a ruse. This was a move. And there was a very young, bushy-haired girl who asked very stupidly, what's that? Or what's this huge boom microphone, which is essentially this, but like three times the size. It's a microphone, you idiot. What do you think it is? And that same bushy-haired girl I met 3 months later as Emma Watson. Yeah. And I think maybe I got the part of Draco from being such a dick to her. So I don't...
And I mean,
it's funny how life works, isn't it?
Also, you know, so you get the part, the Potter... This is all seeming so... effortlessly chronological, it's great, but suddenly you find yourself in these movies, and of that group of kids in those big parts, you're the oldest by a little way, right?
Yeah, somewhat different. The Phelps twins who play the Weasleys, I think they were probably 14, 15.
Right.
I think I was 12, I think, or 12, 13, more or less. Also 12, 13 with three older brothers going on like 25.
Yeah.
Emma was very much, I'd also done, not to make it sound as if I'd done things before, but I had been on a film set before. I did understand the process of what was going on. Largely speaking for Emma, Daniel Rupert and Emma, Daniel Rupert and, well, for a lot of them, for Matt, it was a very new experience. So it was, I was somewhat more laissez-faire, is that the correct French?
Yeah.
I didn't give too many fudges, shall we say. I just wanted to go home and play football with my friends, which was very Draco, which I think laid into that. It was a very different experience for me to some of the others, definitely.
Purely because you were a little bit older and had the experience which they didn't have.
A bit of both. I think a 12-year-old and a 9-year-old would probably struggle to hang out that much.
Yes, sure.
I don't know why, but I just think the difference between a 14 and a 16-year-old is somewhat more, it's easier. We all grew up at different stages. And it was only really towards the later years of shooting the films that we all sort of became this one unit. Before that, there was definitely age gaps and... yeah, also a different experience of, I was there for 2 weeks and 2 weeks off. I literally went to Hogwarts and then went back to Muggle school with bright blonde freaking hair. So I got the best of both worlds. Also the worst of both worlds. Believe me, my friends did not think the blonde hair was cool at all. But I did get to experience that, whereas I know that, largely speaking, a lot of other actors didn't get that opportunity.
And of course, a lot of the book really traces your developing relationships with the other actors, with Daniel, with Emma, who turned out to be an incredibly, you know, close friend of yours, and with the directors as well. And it strikes me it must have been quite, I mean, obviously some of the actors changed part, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, like Richard Harris becomes Michael Gambon. But then one of the biggest changes surely must have been the directors coming in with it. I didn't seem to read quite so much about that in the book, but the way those people coming in and replacing another director with the same group of actors playing essentially, you know, the same roles, but then the new director comes in with, you know, perhaps a different brief and a different vision and a different approach, and you were already so attached to the very first one. So what was that? What were those relationships like?
Seamless, looking back at it, and I can only celebrate the producers and the right. And the people that put all that together, because Chris Columbus is the reason why these Potter films have done so well. Make no mistake, he found Daniel, he found us, and he created this environment that was essentially just us mucking about that allowed these two films to be made. I've heard someone say that arguably they look a little bit more distant to the more recent ones. The recent ones wouldn't exist without Daniel. I think the craft or the choice, I can only assume, of bringing Alfonso in for the third film. Well, you know, another thing to remind ourselves here is that, like, we were 11 and 12 when we started. We were 23 when we finished. We grew up as people, and the characters grew up with them. So it was important that the films grew up with them. And I think Alfonso put in the teenage element. Crushes on set started to happen rather than us bickering, you know, as teenagers sort of do. And that continued throughout. I can only put that down to the mastery of the people what were behind it, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a credit to the producers that it all seemed that way to you. In the book, and I'm sure, is it newly published or has everybody read it? Great. So you're going to love a lot of the anecdotes about the great, great actors that you work with. There's fantastic stories about Michael Gambon and Maggie Smith and Offset in another movie, poleaxing Jodie Foster with a kick to the face, I think.
Yes.
We don't have to go into it. They can read it in the book. But it's true, right? You can confirm that.
It's true. And not that anyone's a Silence of the Lambs fan, which I am now. But yes, I kicked Jodie Foster in the face pre-Potter, and I had the worst audition of my life with Sir Anthony Hopkins, which you will read in the same chapter.
And there are so many, you know, great actors you work with, and many of them, you know, sadly no longer with us. And I think you might like to bring up the most recent sad death, which is national treasure Robbie Coltrane.
Yeah, sadly Robbie passed a few days ago. For those of you who don't know, he played Hagrid. We should take a moment to raise our wands and have a little applause, I think. I know he'll be smiling down at all of this. Robbie was the greatest probably the, well, it's hard to pick, but one of the greatest early influences on the Potter films. And the story is summed up quite beautifully where at our first table read.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Which means it's like 30 cast members. None of us know what the monkeys were doing. But we're in a room and our name is put out in the front of us. Tom Felton, Draco Malfoy, etc. And before we start reading the script, as is the way of discerning whether the script is any good or not, we each say our names and we each say which character we're playing. And I was terrified about even getting my own name right, let alone Draco Malfoy's. And of course, Robbie picked his up and said, I'm Emma Watson and I'm playing Hermione. To which Emma Watson picked hers up and said, I'm Robbie Coltrane playing Hagrid. And that, it just set the tone. I didn't realize it then, but I realize it now, how easy it is to intimidate people on a film set by thinking that you're doing something important.
Right.
Because you're not. You're not saving the world. You're not curing cancer. You're playing. You're literally in a suit and a giant Hagrid costume. And Robbie was the first one to look after everyone, but also remind us that this is all fun and games.
Well, and also there's a lot of great stuff about where you kind of, Alan Rickman and Ralph Fiennes, these are people with incredible presence. And it seems that in a way the actors divided up into people who were wanted to get playful with the children, and like Mark Williams seems to have been somebody, or Rick Mayall, there were kind of big kids amongst the actors. Then there were ones that were much more aloof, and while you never disliked anybody as far as this book is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get much more intimidating to work with more serious.
Yeah, and you're spot on. On that same table reading, Rick Mayall, for those of you who don't know as well, he's a famous British actor, Blackadder, The Young Ones.
Bottom.
Thank you. But I remember there was a lunch break in between reading the scripts, and he said, he was the first one to stand up to say, right, race you to the toilet, and just ran off like a furious nut. No one laughed at the time. It was like, who the hell is this mentor? But it was very British and very like of their time. And Rick Mayall sadly got not cut out of the film, but Peeves was just another, but it was another character that sadly wasn't able to be in the films. Otherwise, they'd all be 7 hours long. But Alan.
I think one of them was, wasn't it?
They split it into two. Oh, yeah. But Alan Rickman was my favourite because.
That's a great story as well, that.
Yeah, Alan's the best. I should precursor this as well to say we all had a limit of people that we were allowed to bring into set. And this is prior it being quite what it is now. It was just legally you weren't allowed to bring more than four guests. Alan brought 8 people every single day. And claimed that they were his cousins or his brother's sister's dog walkers. And they weren't. They were just kids from children's hospitals that were local that had their families there. And he just ignored the rules and just said, I'm going to do it regardless. And even better than that, when they got there, Daniel would say, hello, this is Harry. Ron would give him a high five. Emma would give them a cuddle. I would be ignored completely because no one wanted to speak to Draco. In fact, they found it more creepy when I was being friendly.
Yeah.
But Alan would go up to them, to Snape, and have one look in their eye, usually possibly some boy in a wheelchair, and clip him across the back of the ear and tell him to tuck his shirt in. As Snape, obviously. And that was kind of... it was wonderful. It was a wonderful moment of realizing that he had a wicked sense of humor and a huge heart, Alan. But he also knew when to be Alan and when to be Snape. So I learned a lot from him.
You say that. You say in the book that as a kid there was a fine line, you know, I presume as an actor in movies, a fine line between being normal and being reckless. According to this book, you got quite a reputation as a pretty bad influence on the set.
I wasn't a good influence. Draco Malfoy, come on. Yeah, I wasn't a bad... I had the very, very opposite of Draco's life. I had three older brothers, loving parents. Draco had the opposite. I know he's a slimy... Yeah. He's not someone that anyone should look up to ever, but he also didn't really have much of a choice in his time. And as I grew up, I sort of got a chance to sympathize with that a little bit. Sorry, I thought you were about to say something.
Not, I wasn't, except to say that you offer on page 168 a pretty great, I suppose, defense of Draco, in the sense that, you know, when even, you know, there's that old thing about if you're playing a bad guy in the movies, you've got to work out why the bad guy thinks he's doing the right thing, however warped that is, and, you know, that kind of thing. And it's a fantastic section where you, which you begin by saying Draco Malfoy was the boy who had no choice, dominated by his overbearing father, cowed into his fear of his life by Voldemort. His actions were not his own. Do you want to talk about that just a little bit?
I mean, I don't defend... There's no denial, oh, Draco was this hero that never got a chance. He wasn't. It wasn't some case of, oh, Harry being given the fact that he had no parents and no money and no loyalty that led him to making all these right choices. These are just parts of our characteristics. But it all comes from Joe's stories and the fact that all of these characteristics are in us in some way, shape, or form, whether it's Snape's and Hagrid's, Draco's, or Harry's. They're all within us, and they all shouldn't be quite so easily discernible as hero or villain. Don't get me wrong, Voldemort's a villain. He's a shitty hugger, I'll tell you that, Matt. It's not about defending everyone, but it is about having... I do believe that Draco was purposefully built to be a slimy, slightly two-dimensional character for at least many years, for us to be able to understand at the end of it that he was more or less a product of his parents and his lack of love.
And perhaps one of the reasons he was a shitty hugger is because it was your idea to do the shitty hug. Wasn't it?
No.
But wasn't what? Which was the one? So maybe I'm muddled. But which was the one where you didn't even know it was going to be in it in the movie?
This was it. Okay,
that was I thought that was your idea.
Are you joking? I mean, I would. Have you seen Voldemort? I would never in a million. No, it was. I don't know what happened, to be honest with you, but.
But you didn't know it was going to be in it until you saw the movie.
No. For those of you who don't know, the end of the Hogwarts films is with like the Gryffindor, Hogwarts students on one side and the Death Eaters on the other. And Draco, my character, gets asked to walk across back to his parents, and he does so in a last call of his mother's words. And I've got a lot of love for Helen McCrory as well, who's no longer here with us tonight, but. If there is any love for the Malfoy family, it should be for her, because she's the one that brought Draco's softness to it. I digress. Anyway, I did this walk at least 50 times. We shot it all like months and months and months of it. And it was only one of the last ones that I was walking past Ralph Fiennes, who plays Voldemort in head to toe with hundreds of people around, that he opened his arms up. And I was walking going, he's not fucking trying to hug me. And then I was like, he's trying to fucking hug me. Okay. So I hugged him. But what was quite strange about it for me is that was the one that made the scene. Because they had so many choices of others, but it was so right, because there's something so horrible about seeing the worst entity in the world trying to have a sign of affection, and there's something so horrible about seeing poor young Draco being subdued to it. So it was a horrendous hug. I advise you don't hug Voldemort whenever you're there. But it was a cool little moment that was featured in the films.
I think there are a lot of poignant, you know, things in the book, many of which approach the difficulty of growing up doing that, you know, that being how, you know, the major way you face the world. And towards the end of the book, you know, it goes into your own, you know, problems, you know, and rehab and stuff you've gone through. And it makes for a couple of the bits, that scene where you're, we don't need to talk about it now, but that scene where you're running away on the Pacific Coast Highway, yeah. I mean, that's harrowing stuff.
No, I'd like to talk about it now.
Okay.
Because I think even the word rehab has such a connotation that should be completely eradicated. Rehab, rehabilitation is... Because my mum struggled with it. She was like, well, what are you doing? I'm like, Mum, I'm not using anything or particularly the substances or my choice of life are not the problem. They're symptoms of something else that's going on. So I was lucky enough in Los Angeles after really sort of relearning. It's one thing auditioning as a 12-year-old, okay? All you got to do is turn up and just look remotely like the guy and bullshit about that you know what Gringotts is and then... Here you are. It's another thing to really learn the craft and actually and work on it and care about it, which I do massively. So like, it took me a long, hard few years to sort of apply myself to get that right. My sort of breakdowns or highs and lows, you know, I just feel like you can't celebrate the rain without you can't celebrate the sun without acknowledging the rain. And I hadn't acknowledged the rain for a long time. I hadn't been home. And my intervention and my time in rehabilitation was not to do with any particular substance or with any particular thing that I was doing. It was more a case of life can be better and it's okay to crumble sometimes. So the reason why I made sure that they're in their book, because if anyone else has or is going through that or knows people, it's so fucking gay.
And apart from the, you know, learning the craft again as a beginner, almost in a way, you've got this bit here, which I found moving. Throughout my childhood on the set, Potter set, I'd had structure imposed upon me without knowing it. I was told when to turn up, etc. There is something calming about that kind of certainty. And when it's part of your life for such a long time, its absence can disorientate you. Yeah. Now, you know what I mean? Now it was back. We woke at sun, and then, you know, so you were in rehab, lovely. You were able to find a little of that again.
Yeah, yeah, it's lovely.
I found that very moving bit of the book.
I just think... maybe we underestimate the value of a 9-to-5, and 9-to-5 is said obviously because that's the sort of general hours of it, but this consistency, and I know people get pissed off with having to wake up when it's raining to have to go to work, and I know they look forward to going home to watch the next Potter film afterwards. I didn't have that. I was at the whim of whenever they wanted me there. And also most of the days I was at the Lucent Studios for well over 1,000 days in my time. Most of them not used. As in you put your wig on and you get ready and you sit in a room with no one else. Mm. And you luckily I had my brothers my brother and I had friends on it, but it's not exactly how teenagers sort of grow up. And I was lucky to have enough sort of normal muggle experience to be able to sort of balance it out. But yeah, it was a bit jarring when things all finished, which was kind of really nice. I just finished my first play. And
In London, right?
Yeah, it was in London, yeah. And actually I saw Mr. Potter a few days ago and I thanked him for how many people that he's brought to the theatre. A theatre is something that's really dear to my heart and my mum's. So I got to have my first 9-to-5, really. For the last 18 weeks, I've had to be at a certain point at a certain time and make sure that I deliver. And it's a rewarding part of our progression sometimes in life. And I don't think we should underestimate how important that can be.
And though, you know...
This is not a self-help book, by the way. I don't know anything. Ignore my advice, just enjoy the Potter story.
It is full of good stories. But you, so if it's about what's next, not what's now, if you know what I mean, what do you think is next? Or what do you, before we move on, by the way, to the first question, which is going to be very regimented, you'll see how it works if you haven't been to one of these before. What do you think, or what do you hope is next for you?
I'm not sure what you mean, to be honest with you, because in a world of constant reminders that there is a tomorrow, and there is a reminder of what you said yesterday, I strive to be right here, right now, and I applaud any one of you that doesn't have a phone out recording this. Not that I think there's a problem, because I do the same things at Paul McCartney concerts when my mum wants to sit. I've got no beef with it, but my dog, Willow, is my hero, and she reminds me... Oh, piss off! I've had enough about Willow. But she's just the reminder of how it should be. I know we've got a lot to protect for the future, and I know we've got a lot to sort of look back on and learn from, but Christ alive, we're here right now, and we're okay, and we're healthy, and we're happy. That's enough, isn't it? So that's what I'm focusing on right now.
And interestingly enough, of course, Paul McCartney, not your favourite Beatle.
Don't tell him, mate.
Well, you say it in the book.
I don't know. Yeah, you know, someone asked me the other day, they were like, oh, so your struggles in rehabilitation clinics. And my first instinct was, how the fuck do you know about that? I've written it in a book. I forgot people were going to read it. I'm a huge fan of all the Beatles, but George Harrison has a particular place.
My favourite too. All right, so we are, Mr. Tom Felton, we are going to have some questions for you. There are people here with microphones. We're going to go on the left hand first, so put up your hand. And how about that person right there?
Hi.
Thanks,
man. My name's A. My quick question is, how did you manage your dating life on set? If you had one.
Well, let's get straight down to it.
Well, once Rupert said no, Daniel was the only option. He said no too. There's no dating life as much. You know, we all went home to our own places and had our own friends and so forth. I'm sure there were crushes along the way. I know there were some crushes along the way. But it was also mostly time doing, a job with hundreds and hundreds of other people around, especially adults. So maybe there was less time for sort of teenage flings to develop as much as they could do. But... I'll leave it at that.
You didn't go back to four little houses next to each other like the Beatles in Help. That would have been
Sadly
great.
Not, no.
Who have we got over here? There you go. How about this lady?
Hi. Hello, I'm Katie. I was wondering, how were you excited or nervous to do the 20-year reunion?
We were all nervous. Seriously, I remember seeing Daniel when he got out the car, and he almost... I'm wary of cameras and stuff. We were all nervous, yeah, and we were all... it'd been the first time that we'd all been together for a long time, but it was typically British, as it was when we left. We all gave each other a hug, we all said goodbye, and we saw each other down the line as we went along. When we were reunited, it was all for a great cause. I think all of us would have felt left out if we weren't there. So we saw each other... We hugged, we went to the Great Hall, and then just got back to normal life, really. We were really lucky that we got to go out for dinner afterwards. It wasn't just all about the stuff that you saw on camera. Like, believe it or not, we actually are really close friends and care about each other a lot. So it was nice to be able to have that moment as well.
Hi, my name's Amanda. I wanted to ask if you could have the chance...
What house are you at, Amanda?
Slytherin.
Do we have any Slytherins in the house? The rest of you can bugger off. Sorry, Amanda. Okay. Interrupt.
I wanted to ask, if you got the chance to work with anyone in the Harry Potter universe again, who would it be?
No one's ever asked me that. That's really difficult. I don't know. Probably Daniel. I think Daniel's... got so much great work to come. So I look forward to seeing what he works on. But honestly, pick any one of them. There's not someone that I'd love to play, to work with Jason Isaacs again, who plays my dad, Lucius. Yeah, and also, like, Emma and I are close friends. We also share a lot of art with each other. We're always sort of slightly looking for, is there a role or a job that one day we could work back together on? So, yeah, any one of them, really.
There's a high hand on your left coming up here. It's a very good shape on that hand.
Hi, I'm Catherine.
Hello, mate.
So there's kind of this Facebook meme that you came up with the line, I didn't know you could read, just off the top of your head in Chamber of Syncrets. Can you tell me if that's true? Because it's always on Facebook. And two, like any other unscripted stuff that you really loved.
I believe it to be true. Well, and Columbus has, Chris, the director, has confirmed it, but I also believe that it was his influence that either gave me the line to say or literally told me what to say. Bearing in mind these...
I think in the book you say he told you to say.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's true, but right. I would never claim to have that genius moment without... thinking that I had a lot of influence. And bearing in mind with the Potter films, I actually spoke about this earlier with a few of the other cast members, we learned so much about where to stand, how to look, this angle, that angle. My when we were playing Quidditch, my bludger was a geezer holding a fishing pole with a tennis ball on it, you know. It may look brilliant on the screen, but that's not what we were reacting to. And that's kind of how we learned... really how it was. So you can imagine that improvising was not encouraged. They spent a lot of time trying to bring in as much of Joe's brilliant work into these stories that it wasn't encouraged. But it was, yes, it was take two. It was Crabbe and Goyle, who had been polyjuiced. Thank you. Or rather, Ron, sorry. Yeah. Fuck's sake. I always get in trouble at these things. It was Harry and Ron who had been, polyjuiced briefly into Gregory Goyle and Crabbe, yes. And it was after the third or fourth take that Chris, I think, or we both had the notion that it might be snarky to comment the fact that I didn't know that Gregory Goyle could read. And it was one of those ones, it was a bit like Voldemort's hug. It was another random thing that only happened a few times, but it was obviously ended up in the final cut.
Hi, I'm Hannah.
Hello, mate.
So I had a question for you. So you were kind of cast in this like villain role in a very crucial like time of your life for self-development and really becoming yourself. So I wanted to know, like, how did becoming like kind of a villain impact you emotionally as a kind of tween teenager? Sorry, I'm a mental health.
No. I'm a mental health
professional in education.
Well, first of all, can we get a round of applause for this woman's help? Yeah. Listen, this is not a self-help book. The Potter books are not self-help books, but it's helped more people than I've seen any other piece of literature or film or music than anything. And I'm here to celebrate that. So I hope that Potter is helpful in your work. For me personally, I just felt very lucky that I had three older brothers that they cared not at all when I got her. And they care even less now. They got no idea where I am. I think they've read the book, maybe. But they do that in the most loving way, in the same way as I love them. So I've had a very, very lucky balance of living. The book opens with me getting arrested. Yeah, my mum didn't know that story. Yeah, she wasn't happy at all. But that was kind of important to me that this isn't some story about me making the Potter films. This is just my story thus far. And part of it was getting caught stealing a porn DVD when I was 13 years old. I'm glad my mum's not here.
And for that, you got your face up on the Hall of Fame of fevers from that particular.
Let's move on. The weather's been beautiful today, hasn't it?
Let's get the microphone down to somebody in the middle of one of these rows. There you go. There's a person in the middle of a row right there.
Hi, I'm Gabrielle. I'm a Hufflepuff. Sorry.
Let's move on.
Hey!
Don't worry, half my family are Hufflepuffs too. It's okay.
Didn't you take the test and didn't you find out you actually
were? Yes, move on. Okay. Come on.
Sorry. I'm sorry. So I was just curious, when your friends, you know, other actors and whatever, found out you were writing a book, did you get a lot of texts, calls, emails saying, you're not going to say that story, are you?
That's a good question.
No.
No, come on.
The fun part was I never tried to write a book. These are literally not my diaries, but my scraps of paper that have been embellished through a bit of hard work over the last couple of years. What I did have to do, which was quite fun and disconcerting at times, was cross-referencing stories. So like Gregory Goyle, Josh, who's like one of my best friends on the set, his notion of things was somewhat different to mine. So when I sent him the story to say, are you okay with this being published? He was like, hey, that's not at all how it happened. And we sort of met somewhere in the middle and agreed with it. But it's amazing how over the years, like, not that the memory gets distorted, but it can blur certain facts of it. So I believe I've been given the thumbs up from all of them that none of this is untrue. But I also know that it's just a memoir, really, of me growing up as a teen. It just so happened that half of it was at Hogwarts.
Oh. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Cheers, mate.
There's somebody over in the corner, over there, over on the wall there.
I like your jumper, by the way, with the hearts. Cheers.
Hi, I'm Amelia.
Hello, lovely.
Hi.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Oh, my God.
I'm a lot friendlier than Draco, I promise.
I just want to know, what was it like going from screen acting and all that to a play where there's... Oh, my God, I can't speak. I'm so sorry.
You're okay. Take your time. Just breathe. We're all right.
Where there's, like, a play where there's no, like, do-overs and stuff and everything's live.
Yeah, it was quite a difficult shift, to be honest with you, because people consider acting to be the same thing, TV or film or theatre. One thing to recognise is that with film is that when you do Dumbledore's death scene or even times where the lines scared Potter or wherever they are, they're said probably once or twice or thrice, if I didn't remember it the first time round. They're there for a second and then they're gone. And then 2 years later, if it made the final cut, you'd see it. And then 2 years after that, someone might at a Comic Con in Australia would say, hey, say the line. And I'm like, what line are you even talking about? And I highlight this because the film, the product of the films, at least, is the work of so many other people. I'm merely a chess piece that was allowed to sort of do my thing and then bugger off, really. Whereas on stage, as I'm learning in this very second, you don't have a second take. Whatever you bugger up now affects how everyone moves. So it was a really new skill for me to learn, but also one that essentially you're doing an hour and a half long scene for 150 nights in a row versus saying these few scenes that you learn temporarily and then move on to the next one. So it took me a long time to sort of get to grips with that, but I really enjoyed it, and I sincerely hope to come over this side of the pond and do theatre. And I'll rely on all of you to turn up. Okay.
I thought it'd be quite fun to find a man or a boy with a question. Is there anybody? Yeah, look, there's one. Look.
My name's Will.
What's up, Will? I'm Tom.
It's cute. It's really cute that everybody's introducing themselves at this one as well.
As they should do.
Yeah, sure.
I feel, you know, it's the most awkward is that people come up to me all the time and treat me like, well, they react as if I've known them forever, which is lovely, but I always say, I'm Tom, and they go, I know. I'm like, just tell me your name, please. So what up, Will? Good to speak to you, my friend. What's your question?
How did you feel when you made the last Harry Potter movie?
sad in a heartbeat. Relieved and sad in a weird way. It was such a big part of our life. How old are you, young Will? 11. Right. So you were my age when you became Draco or ish. So I'll ask you when you're here 10 years later how you feel about this answering this question. It was a sad, melancholy event. We genuinely believed, I think, that all of us would have seen the Potter fan flame dwindle over the next decade or two. It's mental. I mean, and it's not even nope, it's like no shit. And I'm so proud of that. And it sounds cheesy, I know, but like the whole thing about sharing this is for the muggles that got us here. And you're all one of them. So the fact that this is all still going and still increasing, most fans here probably weren't even born when the first book was being written. So it's a reminder of how these... let's not go into names and ages. You get my point, okay? So yeah, it was a sad time, but needless to say, we've all seen each other a lot since.
There's a beautiful bit in the book where you say, as the actor who played Draco Malfoy, I see myself as a placeholder in people's memories. Seeing me transports them to a different time and place in the same way that listening to a particular song can be evocative of something else. I think that's really beautiful. Tell us, though, a little bit, just quickly, about that placeholder.
I think these stories have a big place in a lot of people's hearts, and I've seen it from around the world, literally. There's not a single country I've been to where they haven't had some sort of passion for these stories, and it brings people together, and it brings all sorts of backgrounds, cultures, generations together. So the fact that I have a small piece of a placeholder, because I'm not Draco, in case you haven't realized, and if I didn't turn up for that audition that day, someone else would have. And you'd probably still be here, and you'd probably still be really passionate about... And I'm not undermining what my particular efforts were. I'm just highlighting all of these are just pieces of the stories that were created that mean so much to people now. And we all expected this to sort of slowly die down. The fact they're not is another reason why I'm making this book and releasing it and saying, like... Shout outs to all of you, man. Like, keep this fan flame going and keep the positivity whatever unites us right now is a good thing, and nothing has done more so than Potter. And if I can be a small part of that, then fuck it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd just like to say, on behalf of the Philadelphia Free Library, thank you very much to Tom Felton.
Thank you so much for being here. Before I go, yeah, I don't want to forget the shout out to my mum. Would you mind doing one? This is a Slytherin phone case, before you ask. Okay. Me too. My mum doesn't do social media, but if you can just say hi to my mum right now, that'd be great. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.